content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from AAA Go Magazine, National Geographic, The News and Observer, and The New York Times. Now, before our journey begins on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. As we enter the month of December, it's hard to believe that 2020 is only days away from transitioning to a new year. This comes as we celebrate the holidays and prepare to welcome 2021. Of course, we must confess that nagging question haunts our thoughts. Will 2021 be better than 2020? We'll have to journey forward to find out. In the meantime, we can enjoy a Mount Pleasant holiday presented by writer Vanessa Infanzon. Her article found in the November-December 2020 issue of AAA Go magazine. Imagine celebrating the holidays somewhere other than home. The thought has certainly crossed my mind. Break tradition and do something different to mark annual events. Wake up somewhere new, eat from a special menu, or get takeout. Change can be good, especially after this year. Mount Pleasant, South Carolina makes a great home-away-from-home base for a holiday vacation. The town offers accommodations, dining, and attractions that meet the needs of couples and families. Here are some ideas. Make memories. Pick up gifts at the 21st Annual Mount Pleasant Holiday Market and Craft Show. It happens on Saturday, December 12th. Now, you can catch the fireworks display at the 25th Annual Christmas Light Parade on Sunday, December 13th. Enjoy decorated floats, community groups, and school marching bands as they parade through the streets of Mount Pleasant. Add the Holiday Festival of Lights at James Island County Park in Charleston, November 15th through December 31st, to your evening activities. You can ride on a holiday train, visit Santa Claus, get treats from Santa's sweet shop, and view a 50-pound sand sculpture. Bring sticks and marshmallows to roast at fire pits throughout Santa's Village, and if you bring a canned good Monday through Thursday, you're going to get $5 off your admission. Home Away. The cottages on Charleston Harbor feature 10 cottages overlooking the water and Charleston Harbor or a private lagoon, and each cottage is set up like a comfortable home with a kitchen, living area, two bedrooms, and a screened-in porch. The ultimate holiday retreat has a four-night stay minimum and is available from December 19th through December 30th, and the package includes a 6-foot live tree decorated with lights. You can bring ornaments from home for a tree trimming party. Now, Hotel Indigo Mount Pleasant celebrates the local art and culture of Mount Pleasant and its surrounding areas. The property opened in July 2018 with locally inspired artwork, a resort-style pool and restaurant. Eliza's Bar and Kitchen is named for Antigua-born Eliza Lucas Pinckney, who brought indigo seeds to South Carolina and shared it with other plantations, making it one of the state's most important cash crops. Next, places we can play and eat. In addition to booking your stay at one of the above-mentioned accommodations, you can create an itinerary of activities for yourself. History and military enthusiasts will appreciate Patriot's Point and a tour of the USS Yorktown, known as the Fighting Lady. Learn the details about how this aircraft carrier was used in the Vietnam War and the Apollo 8 mission. Visit Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island or the Charles Pinckney National Historic Site in Mount Pleasant. Travel through time at Boone Hall Plantation and Gardens. Englishman Major John Boone founded this plantation in 1681. Learn more about Black history and Gullah culture through exhibits, presentations, and tours. Walk along the Mount Pleasant Pier and Memorial Waterfront Park. Take a photo on Pitt Street Bridge, once a trolley bridge to Sullivan's Island, and shop in the Old Village Historic District. Grab a milkshake and sandwich from the old-fashioned soda fountain and counter at Pitt Street Pharmacy. Nearby Charleston provides day excursions such as a carriage ride with Old South Carriage Company or a walking tour with Charleston Pirate Tours. Enjoy a tasting or specialty cocktail after a tour at High Wire Distilling Company. Visit the Charleston Tea Garden Plantation to learn how tea is produced or stroll through Magnolia Plantation and Gardens. Venture out to Mount Pleasant restaurants. For breakfast, check out Vicious Biscuit, Flying Biscuit, or Eliza's Bar and Kitchen. Head to Shim Creek for waterfront seating at Red's Ice House, Shim Creek Bar and Grill, Tavern and Table, or Vickery's Bar and Grill. Order the award-winning Bloody Mary and Shrimp and Grits from Page's Okra Grill. Eat a traditional Southern lunch at the grit counter with grit bowls, fried chicken, and peach tea. Brunch at Grace and Grit, BLT, omelet, Belgian waffle with homemade blueberry jam sauce and maple syrup. And add a cocktail, named the Azalea or the Bee's Knees, and you'll be happy you left home for the holidays. And by the way, coming up on January 31st of 2021, you can come back for what they call the day-long Low Country Oyster Festival. Again, that's on January 31st of next year. It's an all-day celebration with live music, contest, arts and crafts, oysters and other foods from local restaurants and food trucks. And the money raised supports local nonprofit organizations. And boy, does that sound like a lot of fun down there around Mount Pleasant, just outside of Charleston, South Carolina. Well, how many times have you stepped outside in the past year and looked to the skies? Imagine that you might live on a distant planet or maybe in another galaxy, perhaps. How would you be able to travel to Earth if you did so? Well, believe it or not, there is a map to help you. NASA sent this map into space in 1972 and in a reboot in 2020. Now, its purpose is to lead extraterrestrials to Earth. Of course, that raises another question. Is that a good thing? Nadia Drake and Scott Ransom explain how the map came to be and offer their take on who might be looking for us in their article, Earth or Bust, A Map for Aliens, published in the October 2020 issue of National Geographic. A half century ago, astronomers designed a map that would point to Earth from anywhere in the galaxy. When they sent it into space, reasoning that any alien smart enough to intercept a spacecraft could decode the map and uncover its origin. Many movies and TV shows have used variations on this theme as a plot point, but we didn't borrow it from science fiction. It's reality. Truth is, this tale has been part of my family's lore since I was, or before I was born. Growing up, I'd heard stories about the map and seen its depiction on multiple interstellar spacecraft, and several years ago, I found the original penciled-in pathway to Earth where my parents had stashed it. More on this later. That was an exciting find. Then came the buzzkill. This original map won't be good for much longer, cosmically speaking. The signpost it uses will disappear within tens of millions of years, and even if they don't, the map would point toward our home for only a fraction of the 200 to 250 million years it takes the Sun and other nearby stars to spin once around the Milky Way. Sure, the chances of aliens intercepting the map are astronomically improbable, but if that did happen, an outdated map would be useless rather than helpful, and that wasn't the goal. Why on earth does this map even exist? It was December 1971, and NASA was getting ready to launch Pioneer 10, a spacecraft that would sweep by Jupiter and make the first reconnaissance of the solar system's biggest planet. More stunningly, Pioneer 10's brush by Jupiter would sling it onto an interstellar trajectory, making it the first ever human-made object destined to leave the solar system. With a little help from his friends, the astronomer Carl Sagan decided that the craft ought to carry a greeting from humanity, a message identifying and commemorating Pioneer's makers that would be interpretable by anyone who found it. NASA agreed and gave Carl less than a month to design the message. This is when Carl's friend, the astronomer Frank Drake, enters the story. Frank is also my dad, and among other notable accomplishments, he is credited with conducting the first scientific search for noisy aliens and with formalizing a framework for estimating the number of detectable alien civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. Carl asked Dad for help crafting the message while the two of them were in San Juan, Puerto Rico for a meeting of the American Astronomical Society. Dad recalls that in the lobby of the San Geronimo Hilton, he and Carl quickly came up with ideas about what to include. Line drawings depicting humans, a rendering of the spacecraft, and then, in the next moment, we hit on the idea of a galactic map that would pinpoint the location of the Earth in space. Dad designed the map, and in 1972 it flew into space aboard Pioneer 10. The next year, Pioneer 11 launched, ultimately carrying the map past Saturn and now on to the stars. Then in 1977, both Voyager spacecraft left Earth carrying Dad's guide to finding our planet, which is etched onto the cover of the Golden Record. The way Dad designed the map means that it points back to Earth both in space and in time, making it a galactic positioning system, a different kind of GPS, in four dimensions. At the time, Dad and Carl didn't really worry that the aliens who found their message in the bottle might be of the more malevolent variety. How the map was made. Our galactic neighborhood has no obvious street signs, and crafting a map pointing to one planet among the billions and billions of worlds populating the Milky Way is no simple feat. Finding Earth means finding the solar system, and the sun is rather unremarkable. There's really no way to distinguish it from other several hundred billion stars in the galaxy, each of which is tracing its own path around the galactic center and slowly shifting in location relative to its neighbors. That stellar jostling means the constellations spangling Earth's skies won't be the same in our near future, nor do the stars align in the same recognizable configurations from anywhere other than the solar neighborhood. In fact, in about 2,000 years, Polaris will no longer be the North Star, just as it was not the pole star for ancient Egyptian, Babylonian, and Chinese sky watchers. So what to do? Though normal stars with churning nuclear engines in their cores might not have distinctive fingerprints, Dad realized that pulsars, the corpses of stars that once were much larger than the sun, are potentially uniquely identifiable. Discovered in 1967, pulsars spin very rapidly, often hundreds of times per second. Using powerful radio telescopes, astronomers can measure the extreme precision, how quickly pulsars rotate, meaning that each of these spinning stellar relics writes its own signature in space. Dad selected 14 pulsars that could triangulate Earth's position, and he coded information about their rotation rates into the map. It's not your typical map. Appropriately, Dad's pulsar map looks like a fancy asterisk, a radial explosion of hatched lines that intersect at our solar system's location. Briefly, here's how the map works. Each of the lines connect Earth to a pulsar. The hatch marks are binary numbers that reveal the pulsar's rotation rate at the time the map was designed, and line lengths are roughly proportional to distance. Some of the pulsars parked on Dad's map, for example, the Crab and Vela, sit in the centers of beautiful nebula created during the pulsar's violent formations. Presumably, any civilization smart enough to detect and snare a quiet interstellar spacecraft would know about pulsars. And by matching the rotation periods on the map with stellar signposts in the sky, aliens could find their way to Earth relatively easy. In addition, because the energy we see from pulsars comes from their spin, and they slow down over time, Dad's map also points to Earth in the fourth dimension. By calculating the difference between the observed and coded rotation periods, a difference that will be apparent after thousands of years, aliens could figure out how long ago the map was made. Perhaps somewhat surprisingly, Dad's map became lodged in the popular imagination and is now commonly found on everything from T-shirts to tattoos. I guess there's something captivating about always being able to find your way home, even in the most cosmic sense imaginable. Keeping it in the family. A love story. Several years ago, two significant things happened. I found the original penciled-in pulsar map folded away and casually tucked into a tomato box in my parents' closet, and I linked up with the rock climber named Scott Ransom, one of the world's more prolific pulsar astronomers. Scott had been thinking about the Voyagers, the Golden Record, and the pulsar map since he was a 10-year-old in Mansfield, Ohio, watching Carl's Cosmos television show. Some years and an astronomy Ph.D. later, he realized that Dad's map has a near-future expiration date. Its Achilles heel is the same property that lets it pinpoint Earth in time. Pulsars slow down, and ones like Dad had chosen from the few known at the time would fade and disappear within several million years, give or take a few millennia. Coincidentally, Scott had made out a to make a new, more precise, and longer-lived pulsar map, even before we moved in together and portmanteaued ourselves, or mantoed ourselves, into the Dranksoms. Now I write the words that tell our stories, and Scott does the important cartographic stuff, such as choosing pulsars and deriving their binary codes. He occasionally drafts some text passages, but you'll never catch me committing academic acts of astronomy. A newer and better map to Earth. Scott's new map is a GPS for the ages. It navigates to Earth using pulsars inside and outside the Milky Way with a twist. Instead of the more ordinary pulsars Dad selected, the new map employs millisecond pulsars that spin faster, last longer, and have also dead orbital companions. These binary pulsars afford a second set of identifiers, the orbital period of the system, which does not change over billions of years. And crucially, millisecond pulsars age much more slowly than the ones in Dad's map, meaning that it takes thousands of times longer for their spins to become unrecognizable. In addition, Scott included another layer of signposts, pulsars in globular clusters orbiting the Milky Way, ancient clumps of stars that predate the Milky Way. Globular clusters are gorgeous and mysterious, and they are veritable millisecond pulsar factories. By including signposts in these hard-to-miss stellar globs outside the galaxy, Scott's map allows Earth to be discoverable for billions of years, even after the Milky Way stars have trekked around the galactic core multiple times, shuffling their positions and obliterating constellations. And Dad, for the record, thinks that's spectacular. But first, someone has to read it. Dad's map, of course, is still out there, but chances are slim to zero that the pioneers or voyagers carrying it will be intercepted. Though all four spacecraft on interstellar trajectories, space is big, and the next stellar systems on the horizon are many thousands of years away. Plus, the spacecraft Titanium will be completely quiet within the next couple of decades, making them extremely hard to detect. As for sending the new map, there's no Voyager-like space probe scheduled for launch anytime soon. But if this map did hitch a ride beyond our solar system, and if it got scooped up by intelligent space aliens, the map would be quite easy for them to read and follow. And that raises all sorts of questions. Would extraterrestrial beings at those distances have the means to reach Earth? If so, and they head our way, what if they don't come in peace? What if they're hungry, and what if they're not vegetarians? Here's the fundamental question that didn't stop Carl and Dad. It is a good idea to randomly send our address to the cosmos. Today, some folks would have no reservations, given that earthly transmissions already are leaking into space and traveling at the speed of light are detectable by anyone with a decent radio telescope living within 100 light years of us. Other folks, perhaps more cautiously, would hold off on announcing our presence until we know if ETs have honorable intentions. As for the Drakesons, we'd gladly send out the new map to Earth as a bid to ensure that our presence as a species would live on in some form. If that message in a bottle were finally picked up after bobbing and drifting through the galactic ocean for millions or billions of years, someone would know that Earthlings did exist, or with luck, still do. And a little short biography here of our writers. Nadia Drake says, "I'm a contributing writer for National Geographic, and I love getting lost in Earth's buggy, overgrown jungles and then finding my way home." And her partner, Scott Ransom, "I'm an astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is located in Greenbank, West Virginia, and the University of Virginia, which is in Charlottesville. And he loves pulsars, maps, codes, and Nadia." So there you go. Kind of a love letter to the stellar regions beyond, huh? Well, when you talk about outer space, aliens, or extraterrestrials, most likely you're going to encounter another topic. It's called UFOs, or unidentified flying objects, or the more popular term now is UAP, which means unidentified aerial phenomena. Now, in this article, Pilot Photographs a Possible UFO in the Sky Over North Carolina Mountains, our writer, Joe Marisak of the Charlotte Observer, looked at how the Carolinas are considered a, quote, UFO hotbed, unquote. His article published in the October 26, 2020 issue of the News and Observer, so let's travel west to see what he learns. As a 45-year pilot, Charles Cobb had never seen anything like the orange-tinged orb in the North Carolina mountain sky on a sunny late morning in June. The object was round and irregular, he said, and it would suddenly plummet tens of thousands of feet before soaring right back up. Cobb, an 88-year-old Korean War combat veteran, spotted the mysterious object while sitting at Silver Creek Airport in Morganton, where he visits each day to check on the 1940 Piper Cub he keeps in a hangar. Minutes ticked by as the object and its exhaust plume hovered 30,000 feet to 40,000 feet high toward Table Rock, Cobb said. He was referring to the plateaued peak northeast of Asheville that's a popular tourist destination for its panoramic views of the surrounding Linville Gorge, as described by AshevilleTrails.com. Cobb said he finally pulled out his iPad and took photos of the flying object and its opaque center, and that was at 11:18 a.m. on June 12th. It was hard to tell the size, he said, although he distinctly recalled the craft dropping at times to maybe 15,000 feet before shooting back up to at least 30,000 feet. The object vanished at one point when he happened to look down at his iPad, but it soon reappeared, he said. The fact that it could zoom up almost out of sight made this no ordinary object, he's convinced. The craft was also flying parallel during the 15 to 20 minutes he watched it, he said, so it couldn't have been a comet. Comets come toward you, he said. This object always pointed north. Was it a plane? Well, definitely not a comet. Bernard Agier, a board advisor with the Astronomy Club of Asheville, agreed after the Charlotte Observer emailed the club two of Cobb's photos. There is no reported astronomical object, certainly not a comet, in the sky that would appear that bright on that June 12, 2020 date, Agier said in an email. There were no comets then that would be that bright, so they would be visible in the daytime sky. It really looks to me more like sunlight reflecting off a distant jet and its related condensation trail. Typically, that would disappear from sight in maybe less than 20 minutes. Good luck getting a definitive answer on this, he wrote. Now, Carolina UFO hotbed is our next section. The Carolinas are a well-documented hotbed of UFO sightings. One recent study had Charlotte beaming itself up into the ranking of top 10 largest North American cities for total UFO sightings in their past century, the Observer previously reported. Other cities in the Carolinas made related lists for sightings per capita, including Wilmington, Asheville, and Myrtle Beach. Queen City's 153 sightings of mysterious lights, disks, and orbs in the sky since 1910 had Charlotte ranked ninth among the 25 largest cities by population and tops in North Carolina. San Francisco-based True People Search compiled the rankings based on sightings people sent to the National UFO Reporting Center in Davenport, Washington. No one reported a sighting similar to Cobb's that day to the nonprofit center, which maintains a public database of objective UFO data, according to its website. It offers an online form and telephone hotline to report sightings. At 9 p.m., about 10 hours after Cobb's sighting, a Huntersville resident reported a sighting of bright light flares turning 90 degrees in the sky. At 5:25 the following morning, a Salisbury resident saw a spear or teardrop structure streaming across the sky with a vapor trail and cast off glare from the rising sun, according to the National UFO Reporting Center database. Round and irregular object. Cobb said the shape of the object is why he's certain it was no plane. Reflection off a jet, he said. This object, while zooming to incredible heights and coming back down, was always heading in a northerly direction, as the photos show, yet it remained in the general area that I was viewing. A plane of any sort passing through my viewing area would have been out of sight in a matter of a few minutes, he said. Cobb said he's known shown the photos to many pilot friends, who are all as stumped as he is by the object, including a recent American Airlines retiree who flew F-4 Phantoms in the Air Force. None of my flying friends have any idea as to what it was, he said. Cobb lives in Morganton and served on a Navy destroyer during the Korean War. He said he thought the object was a huge kite with a tail at first. He put it out of mind until Wednesday, he said, when he happened upon an airline pilot's account on YouTube of a mysterious object that came within 100 feet below him on a flight from Dallas-Fort Worth to Charlotte in 2003. Nearly 100 passengers were aboard when the pilot maneuvered to avoid the unknown object. The airline was not named, rather, in the History Channel video that's drawn 339,500 views. Your brain says this can't be happening, but you have to deal with the here and now and the present, the pilot says in the video. 100 feet is a thumbnail away from where you're at, and that distance can be closed in literally a fraction of a second. And Cobb contacted the observer, he said, in hopes someone else might have seen it too. So if you did, call the observer. Okay. Back to Earth and on the shores of Cape Cod for our final romp today. We're going to go where the oyster is their world. Writer and photographer Randy Harris is going to share some images and comments of where pollution, development, and over-harvesting have affected the oyster habitat. Now, this article is from the August 10th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. The onset of the coronavirus with travel restrictions in place worldwide created this series, the world through a lens, which the New York Times runs on an ongoing basis. It begins, when I first met Chris Crowbar, he was a half mile from shore on the tidal flats that stretch far out into Cape Cod Bay. It was 5 a.m., and I was out for a walk at low tide. From a distance, I saw what looked like little black sails in the water. Chris was a spectacle, along with his boat and table in the middle of the bay, like an artist with his easel flying or painting a fiery sunrise. He stood there fastidiously scraping the barnacles off his oysters, then tossing them back into the cages where they'll sit for a couple of years on the floor of the bay. Before the arrival of the Europeans, the native people of Cape Cod, the Nauset tribe, had an abundant supply of oysters. Crassostrea virginica, known as the American oyster or the eastern Wellfleet Atlantic or Virginia oyster, was naturally flush in coastal areas and estuaries where the rivers meet the sea. Oyster reefs were America's coral reefs. Oysters filtered the water. Some adult oysters can filter 50 gallons a day and fed a range of other sea life. In the 18th and 19th centuries, disease, over-harvesting, and new technologies, including developments in dredging, canning, and transportation, transformed America's oyster industry. The native oyster population in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, for example, was nearly depleted. To cope, locals began seeding the waters with young oysters imported from the Chesapeake. In his 1881 report, Ernest Ingersoll wrote that 100,000 bushels of the bivalves once grew fat along the Wellfleet waterfront. Now, a little experimental propagation of the value of a few hundred dollars and about 6,000 bushels of bedded oysters from Virginia, worth perhaps about $5,000 when sold, formed the total active business. Today, America's natural oyster habitat remains greatly diminished. Estimates in the last decade have placed the wild oyster population at some places in the country at just 1% of historical levels. Modern-day aquaculture has changed the game. A company called Aquaculture Research Corporation, founded around 1960, produces shellfish seed, tiny juvenile oysters, also called spat, and sells them to local shellfish farmers. Chris Crowbar is one of those farmers, a native of Easton, Massachusetts. He grew up working on his farmer's clam boat. Today, he sets his hours not by the clock, but by the tide. He has been raising oysters for 5 years on his two-acre farm in the Cape Cod Bay, just beyond First Encounter Beach, the location of the first meeting between the Nauset people and the Pilgrims. So Cape Cod is unique as its oysters, depending on the location. The high tidal waters flush the oysters with a varying mix of fresh water and salt water, and this helps create nuanced flavors. And as you keep that flavor in mind, we're going to have to say so long for today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, they may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.